Today is June 9th at the Phoenix Main Library with a visit with presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich.
yes, I came to the right place. It is such an honor to be here with you on this sunny afternoon with a sky that is as wide open as my heart for the cause of peace, for the cause of social and economic justice. I know that we share this common commitment to a belief that we can change the world, that we can call for peace where there is war, that we can call for hope where there is despair, that we can call for love where there is hate. We know that we have the capacity, through the work of our hands and our hearts, to save this country, to save our world from a type of thinking that says that war is inevitable. We know that peace is inevitable if we're ready to do it. Because this is really a question of who we are as people. Who are we in our hearts? Are we people of compassion? Are we people who believe in justice? Are we people who stand for truth? I know that we are people of compassion. We are people of justice. We are people who stand for truth. And that is why I know that the people of Arizona will support my candidacy, because I reject war as an instrument of policy. War is inevitable. And yet we know in our heart of hearts that can't be so. We understand that there is an imperative for human unity. That when you look across this room and around this room, you see people of many different races, colors, and creeds. We understand that the world is one. The world is one. It is an undeniable physical fact. Human genome. The world is one. We're all made of the same stuff. And the world is one. It is an undeniable spiritual fact. That we're all one people. The world is interconnected. It is interdependent. We can send a message around the globe in a matter of seconds. We can call a loved one or a friend on the other side of the globe in a matter of seconds. We can get on a plane and travel anywhere. The voyage we must take, though, is the voyage deep into the human heart. To find that place where we reconnect with each other in love. In compassion, there is an imperative for human unity. We are called upon not just to end global warring and global warring, but we're called upon to lift up the human condition and end this scourge of war for all time. Ourselves? Do we have the courage to believe in our capacity to stand for peace? Do we have the courage to believe that together we can create a new condition in this country, where we can be a nation among nations once again, where we can work with the world community to meet the challenges of nuclear proliferation. As President of the United States, I promise you that I will work to get rid of all nuclear weapons. We must save this world. Let me share with you a story about a journey that my wife and I took a year ago. I stood on the floor of the House and I challenged our Congress to take a position as South Lebanon was being bombed. I said that it was important for the United States to stand for peace, to bring the parties together, to call for cessation of the bombing. This was in the early days, the first few days that it started. And the bombing continued for more than 6 weeks. My wife and I were the first connected with the U.S. government who went to Lebanon after the war. We saw the destruction in apartment districts in Beirut, but then we went south of the Litani River. And I saw something that I'd never seen before in my life. I've been to Bosnia. I saw a lot of damage and carnage. But what I saw, I was never to prepare for. South of the Litani River. Every structure destroyed. Houses, 30,000 structures destroyed by bombs. Houses, apartments, businesses, churches, mosques, water systems, sewer systems, schools, hospitals, bombed, destroyed. Fruit plantations, destroyed. Everybody you look, destruction. We got out and we walked in village after village with names like Enata, Vinchabil, Gurun Ross. We walked through rubble, and the smell of death was very powerful because there were people still buried in the rubble. And there were individuals sitting in front of their businesses waiting for someone to come in, and behind them was all rubble because that's where they had been every day of their lives, and there was nothing left. They had nothing to do but sit in the chair with everything behind them destroyed. Everywhere we look, destruction. Signs that said, America, this is your democracy, planted in the rubble. Because people understood the connection between U.S. policy and also U.S. funding for armament. People knew that. At 10 o'clock at night, we drove our car into a town that I had read about. I read about this great destruction that had taken place, where a 1,000-pound bomb dropped through the roof of an apartment building, exploded, and crushed dozens of women and children who were in the basement of a little town named Cana of biblical lore, where Christ was said to have performed his first miracle. We arrived about 10 o'clock at night. I wanted to pay condolence respects to the families who had lost loved ones. And when we arrived, only lights in the town were placed in our vehicle. And when we pulled up, we asked people to take us to a place where we could pay our respects. So we were led to a town square that had been converted into a makeshift graveyard. And this gray cement covering had rows and rows of small stands on which were propped up pictures of the people who had been killed in the bombing of Cana. And my wife and I went up and down the rows slowly, and we stopped at one 1566. It was a picture of a little boy about 2 or 3 years old. He had a smile on his face and a fresh haircut and a red sweater and a blue shirt. And it was the kind of picture that years ago, if you took your child to the department store to get his or her picture taken, it was the kind you would take in a department store, and it was just a bright, shining smile of this little boy, and for a second, you could almost feel yourself developing a trace of a smile until you realized that this little boy lay dead to be defeated. The enormity of war just settled on both Elizabeth and I at that moment. We both started crying. And as we stood there, a hand came around to console me. I caught my breath and I spoke. And the gentleman who consoled me moved us down to the next grave. And he pointed at another picture of a woman and 3 children. And he said to the interpreter, "This was my dad." Think of the incredible humanity of the person who had suffered such loss to someone else. And we stood there with him.
Was there loud enough volume coming out of that?
And then moments later, we went across the road through a narrow street over a huge pile of debris. A path that was lit by small motorbikes to the place where the bomb was. And all we saw were the fragments of clothes and shards of the bomb in the rubble. Word spread that an American congressman was in the village. A crowd gathered like that. And we were surrounded. We had no security with us. We were surrounded by people in the village, not really anticipating what could happen next. And suddenly, people started to cry out from the crowd. "We love America. Tell the American people we love them. Tell the American people we want peace." These voices kept coming out from the crowd. "We want peace. We have nothing against Israel. We want to live in peace. Tell the American people," over and over, this plea came. The humanity that was expressed at that moment was so powerful. It was so powerful. People were standing in the rubble when everything they had destroyed. How many American people loved them? We went back across the road to the graveyard. And I went back to the grave with that little boy. And I knelt in the grave. And in front. I promised that I would dedicate myself to helping the greater world. For the children of this world do not have to live in fear of war. For the children of this world do not have to be in peril for their lives. For the children of this world can have for themselves a world of love, of hope, of compassion. Tell the American people who love them for all that our country has done that has not been right the last 5 years. Such great love for us all around the world. I am ready to move forward, to call them. powerful force, powerful force for the people of the world and of this country, so that we can recreate our country to be a place of compassion and of hope and of life and, yes, of love. To be a place where we can believe in the deeper meaning of America again. To be a place where we can have the courage to believe that we can change the outcome. To have the courage to believe in peace.
Becomes a question of anyone who would be
in the White House. What are your standards? What are your standards? Because the standards of any individual who happens to be in the White House inevitably become the standards of the nation. They may not be our standards, but they're held up as being the standards of the nation. And so that's why I introduced that legislation, because I say that we have to abide by our Constitution and have higher standards. And I will tell you something, Lance, that more and more members of Congress will be signing on to this because they're hearing from the American people. And they're asking, what do you stand for? Who is going to be accountable? Next question. Yes.
I'm sure that the last election, Bush stole, and the one before that, what would you do to prevent them from stealing yours?
If you're going to organize votes of big numbers, it's not going to be close. This issue that you raised, Joy, which is, wherever I go in the country, people are worried about the integrity of the election process, as well we should be, after our experience in 2000, 2004. In 2000, I was prepared to vote against certification of the election, but we were asked by the head of the campaign not to do that, that the result that we provided as far as we could. But in 2004, I voted against certification of the election because I saw what happened in Ohio, state that I'm from. How voting booths were not set up in sufficient supply in areas where minorities were known to have voted largely Democratic, and areas where Republicans were sure to vote in big numbers, there was almost an oversupply of voting machines. And there was an attempt to frustrate the exercise of the vote. Everyone knew that. By someone who was one of the principals in the Bush campaign, who happened to be Secretary of State. So here's some of the steps we're talking about. One step is we need to, all of us, be active in monitoring elections. We need to know how elections are conducted at our precinct level. We need to ask the question about what kind of voting technology exists. We need to find out if the laws permit us to be present when the votes are cast and or present when the votes are counted or revealed. I'll tell you another thing. I'm really, my career in politics goes back, believe it or not, 40 years. I started my career 40 years ago this season, okay? And when I started, it was mostly paper ballots.
Yeah.
Now, think about this. Paper ballots. Now, the media wasn't getting reports about the election back as quick as they liked it, but somehow, you had a paper trail. Paper ballot. There was a way to match it up. I really have great concern about this technology by this Diebold company. Because it's too easy to tamper with. And this electronic voting, I think, should be permitted in federal elections. And so, paper ballots, for voting in federal elections. But look, we don't know what the voting rules are going to look like in 2008. But I will tell you this. Every one of us needs to be aware of how they're conducting the elections, what kind of technology they're using, how that technology can be used, abused, or misused. And we need to have everyone aware of that. But the thing we can't do, though, the thing we cannot let happen, it's because we're so disappointed about what happened in 2000 and 2004 that we just say, there's no way we can win, they're just going to steal it all over again. Let me tell you something. That becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. We need to reclaim our country. And that wasn't just some kind of wry humor when I said we need to vote in big numbers. We need to vote in such massive turnouts that people, that there's no question, that it's just this huge wave of support. Yes, sir, I'm going out.
David Brzezinski and Cliff Grinchester, where he said that the United States may be under attack or under Middle East, and it would be falsely blamed on Iran. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm very concerned that a cause for war against Iran is being developed right now. Let me share with you what I've done about that. I have consistently been on the floor of the House challenging the administration's policy. Sometimes as one of the few or only votes in the House voting against resolutions that were designed to set Iran up for attack. And you know, this administration has done the following. They have sent covert ops into Iran to try to destabilize Iran. They have sent, you know, the fleet out to the area, a couple of carriers, to put them in position for an attack. They sent Patriot missiles to the region. They sent nuclear bunker busters to the region. They have a plan with 1,500 bombing targets selected. Okay? It couldn't be more serious. And the same kind of false case that was developed against Iraq, the weapons of mass destruction, they're doing the same thing again. And the same feints with respect to diplomacy. They're doing, it's almost like you're watching in slow motion the same kind of movement towards the war. There is no cause whatsoever for us to attack Iran. None whatsoever. Capability of attacking the United States, it isn't planning on attacking anyone else. Iran is taking advantage of their rights under the non-proliferation treaties to seek to develop nuclear power. Now, I would advise them not to, for a lot of reasons, but they're doing it. They have a right to do that. The United States is basically trying to confuse the issue by saying that the development of nuclear power equates to the development of nuclear weapons. No, it doesn't. There's a huge difference in the amount of centrifuges that you have and the degree of enrichment of uranium. Nowhere near it, and the International Atomic Energy Agency has said they're not even close. So it's not like any human threat. There's no imminent issue here at all. One of the problems is that the Bush administration, President Bush, and Vice President Cheney have both used these words. All options are on the table. How many of you heard this? Well, here's what we have to translate that. What that means, when you have all of those weapons out of the region, when you say all options are on the table, and you have nuclear bunker busters out there, that means it includes using nuclear weapons. Now, for a reason that I don't really understand, that same language, all options are on the table, has infiltrated the language of Democratic candidates. You know, and I'll be quite specific, since Senators Clinton, Obama, and Edwards have all used the same rhetoric. And I'm wondering if anyone's really thought about what this means. So we have no legitimate reason to attack Iran, and one step further, our Iranian brothers and sisters are being put on the spot because if they even send money home to families, if they send medicine to their families, they could be charged with violating sanctions. This is a very dangerous matter right now. So what I'm doing is keeping the lines of communications open. And I'm doing everything I can to meet with people who are intent on trying to assert the cause of peace. We should be engaging in diplomatic relations with Iran. We should be asking Iran to help us resolve the issues in Iraq, because we need their help. See, this is why this campaign is really way to change the office. Because when I say I reject war as instrument of policy, that means that as support for this campaign develops, the people in Washington will understand, not only do people want to take a new direction in Iraq, but they want to and insist on not taking any action at all against Iran. Yet Congress, stripped from a bill, a provision that would have instructed the President to come back to Congress before taking any action against Iran, voted against the bill that would have done the same thing. So we have every reason to be concerned. But again, I want to let you know, if you go away from this meeting with any thought at all about what I'm saying, the thought that I want you to hold uppermost is that I am standing for peace in a clear and unequivocal way. That our hope is to really create a shift in this country, a shift of our politics, where we believe once again in our capacity to create a peaceful nation and to redefine our purpose in the world. Next question.
I want to bring you a little bit closer to home. I'm a public school teacher. I come from South Phoenix. And I'm kind of interested in knowing more about where you stand on No Child Left Alive.
Well put. Here is where you're at. There's a number of different issues here. One is funding. And this goes in with this global warming. The Pentagon budget will be close to $500 billion in the next budget. Only a fraction of that is of $500 billion spent on education. So education is truly not a priority in our country at this moment. No Child Left Behind. What the idea was that we're going to improve educational performance, but the critical error was the focusing on testing changed the purpose of education from learning to being a good little test taker. And and we're pressed on teachers to have to get the results, otherwise the school doesn't get funded. Here's the flaw. It's like a market-based approach to education. It's strictly quantitative and not qualitative. It's masked in saying, well, we want better. No, that's not what it's about. So here is my educational philosophy and policy approach that I would use. First of all, the No Child Left Behind program is essentially over. As far as I'm concerned. I mean, this idea of making education being about this intensive metrics for testing, no. I will go forth with the help of educational psychologists, child psychologists, developmental psychologists, teachers, academicians, parents. I've already thought about this. We're going to shift the direction and the inflection of education. I come from a background, first person in my family to graduate, either side graduate from college, worked two jobs, 80 hours a week for a couple of years to save up the money to go, have a bachelor's and master's degree, and taught at university level, speech and communications. I understand what education means in an individual's life. I go to schools, I look to the left and face of these little children. I see all the hope and dreams reflected in their shining little eyes, and I know our system is failing them. Here's what I will do. Number one, I'll send a bill to Congress to establish a universal pre-kindergarten program so children ages 3, 4, and 5 will have access to full-time free daycare, learning skills, social skills, language, music, and the arts. Prepare these children to learn. When you advocate something like that, the first question you have from anyone in Washington, appropriately, is,
how are you going to pay for it?
And that's what question they didn't ask when we went to war. I indicated to you a moment ago that the budget for the Pentagon is going to be at $500 billion. by 2008. Here's what my plan is. Having served on a subcommittee, an investigative subcommittee that has jurisdiction over the Department of Defense, I know that the department has over $1 trillion worth of accounts they've never reconciled, over 1,100 separate accounting systems, never been able to pass an audit. Money for weapons programs that have nothing to do with anything except continuing to keep the weapons programs going. We're wasting tens of billions. So, where am I going to get the money? How are you going to pay for it? 25% across the board cut on these programs. We are going to have $125 billion, which we're going to put right into education, not only for preschool, elementary, secondary, and college. How are you going to pay for it? But here's the thing, though. It's about shifting what we're talking about in terms of education. Oh, sure, when someone wants to be an attorney, they better be able to pass a test. They want to be a doctor, they better know what they're doing. But when we're talking about children, those elementary grades, we should not be competitive. We should not be having these children compete against each other on grades. It should be about learning. It should be about developing in our children a love of learning. And that should be great.
Thank you. I'm a local lawyer. I've been practicing law for 25 years, and I share your commitment to truth and justice very deeply. Given that truth and justice are such paramount concerns, and given the massive amount of evidence that is scientific and video and available in the public sphere, evidence that many of us have looked at very carefully, will you now admit or acknowledge, I'm not saying anything, will you now acknowledge the searing and obvious truth that World Trade Center 7, Building 7, was brought down through controlled demolition?
I am fully aware of the depth of disappointment that the American people have and the government's response to the events of 9/11, the investigation of 9/11. I understand fully. And I share a lot of the same concerns. I'm now the chairman of a subcommittee which has jurisdiction over all domestic policy in the United States. We've held hearings on subprime lending that racket that is creating an epidemic of foreclosures in inner cities. We held a hearing yesterday on how oil companies are selling ghost gas. As temperatures go up, the energy in the tank doesn't increase. The volume of gas expands. And people are paying $1 or $3 a tank. The gas they're not getting. We are going to hold a hearing on just a couple of issues. I want to start out with a couple of issues. Relating to 9/11, things that were not looked at. I can't tell you it's going to be about Building 7 just yet, but I am open to looking at the evidence. I just wanted you to know. There are other areas that I'm looking at that are more financial type issues, which we are going to start. And frankly, I want you to know this. There is no other committee in the entire United States Congress, no other chairman of the committee, who's ready to say what I've just said. I'm going to stop. Here's the thing that I want all of you to think about, though. We may never know the real truth about how
it's unacceptable.
I can tell you that I'll strive to determine the truth in a way that others won't. But what I'm getting at is this.
Thank you.
That, and it's true that we should try. And I accept what you just said. Thank you. But what we need to do while we're trying to seek the truth, however long it might take, to find
out how old it is. Well, I am so tired
of being laid down in hard hands by the people that I expect to govern and work in my veterans.
Right.
Then I'm beside myself. That's right.
Yes.
Okay,
let me ask you something now. Thank you, and I appreciate you saying that. Now, let me ask you something. How many people in this room feel that that the entire 9/11 investigation ought to be reopened? We are going to start. I'm trying to get a hearing together around September, which is an appropriate point to have a discussion, and to build a hearing around a couple of points that no one's explored that I think would be very important to opening up the whole case. And what I started to say, and I appreciate that there was a better way to say it, is that we need to also try to heal the damage that's been done to us as a result of 9/11. That America was led astray.
Yeah.
And we ended up going into a war against people who did not attack us. 9/11 was misused, okay? Aside from the stuff that we investigated. And so here's what I hope to do in addition to that. What I hope to do is to help to recreate the spirit of our country so we can remember the good that existed among all of us before 9/11. A lot of who we are was changed after 9/11. A lot of who we were was restated. There's so much fear in this country. And so what I intend to do, and I would agree that the truth is a path towards uncovering that.
No matter what it takes, no matter what those truths are, we deserve, and as a people, we deserve the right to pursue whatever justice it entails.
Yeah.
And you're looking at the only person in the entire government who's ready to open up. For your comments. Yes. Okay, question relates to that. People have asked me what would my first few weeks in office look like. I come from Cleveland, Ohio. There's probably a few people here who said the same thing. And I can tell you that, you know, we see our manufacturing base fall apart. And all across northern Ohio, throughout the state, I stood in parking lots where there's rats from in the parking lots, and the gates are padlocked. In a place where they used to make cars. They used to make steel. They used to make automotive parts. They used to make aircraft parts. They used to make machine parts. They used to make washing machines. They used to make bicycles. And now there's just grass growing in the parking lots. And I've gone through small cities around this country, and I've seen small businesses just boarded up. Because industry's closed, and related directly to NAFTA. NAFTA was sold as being a boon to the economy, it's going to create new jobs, and instead the opposite happened. We lost millions of jobs. Now those who passed NAFTA told the American people, we'll fix it, Well, these jobs are going out the door. Let me tell you what I think needs to be done, and let me tell you what I will do. And my first act in office is going to be to take the pen in hand and cancel NAFTA. Very much for trade. But the terms of trade will determine whether we have an $800 billion trade deficit, $240 billion with China, or whether we have some correspondence between what someone sells to us and what we sell to them. So what I'm going to do is to create a new trade structure which is based on workers' rights, human rights, and environmental quality principles. Let me be quite specific. What do I mean by that? I mean that any country the United States has a trade relationship with, in order to trade with us, must have, must provide workers with the right to organize, the right to collective bargain, the right to strike, the right to save workers. Business with must have prohibitions on child labor, slave labor, prison. Come on. Any country that we have trade with must have protection for the air and the water and the land. How does this work? How does this relate to immigration? Well, let's go back to NAFTA's passage. After NAFTA passed, when people in Mexico were told the wages were going to go up, the opposite happened, wages collapsed, the peso collapsed, and people, desperate to survive, started to come across the border at an increased pace. I'm telling you, it's directly connected to we hope. So what happened is that then a system of slave labor, I don't think you can call it anything else, a system of slave labor was created so that a cheap supply of labor came from these corporations who capitalized on it, made huge profits, and now we're at a time where we're told people, well, you put your work in, great, now get out of here. And don't come back unless you pay a lot of money. Oh, you got family here? Too bad. Where's our heart? Where are we? Now, of course, there has to be a path to legalization. What are we talking about? 12 million people were saying that they don't count? Where you had seen people die in the desert? What is this about? So, we need to have a sane and sensible immigration policy. Sounds nice, but it means that we have to have a way for people, if they're going to work here, they better be paid a decent wage and have workplace protection. That is just fundamental. Democrats have trouble selling. And so to me, my grandfather came from Croatia. And he, I'm part of an immigrant experience. How many people here, just to show of hands, had family two, three generations ago who came from another country? Yeah, think about it. I mean, when we attack immigrants, we better look in the mirror. Okay, I got time. I'm just going to go for a couple more questions. I guess you're standing up and you're going to ask a question.
Wait a second.
Pardon?
I'm sorry. I went to the drink. I know about the drink. I'll
talk to
you already. Go ahead.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to tell you something. There are 25,000 famous drivers still in the Mississippi Gulf Coast. That's not kind of Louisiana. Louisiana's just that. I was born in New Orleans. I went through Katrina. I was in Columbia, Mississippi here in Katrina. When I left five weeks ago, there were still families living in FEMA trailers. The inhumanity that I have seen on the Mississippi Gulf Coast
on the Louisiana Gulf Coast, is an embarrassment to this nation. I want to make you aware of something, Sergeant. I'm going to share with everyone in the room. This investigative subcommittee that I'm chair of, we are going to come to Louisiana and perhaps even Mississippi to investigate some of the things you're talking about, to shed some public light.
You go meet a man named Jim
Yaffe. Well, before I leave, I'd like to leave in a few minutes. What I'd like you to do is I'm flying to Vegas for an event tonight and then San Francisco after that. So what I'd like you to do is just give me an email where I can be in touch with you and we'll work together on this.
Yeah? I still got the phone.
Okay.
Okay,
last
who wants to start campaigning for you?
What was that question?
I have boots on the ground. It's too early to start acting fantasy. To start getting your name up, getting the signs up. It is too early to do those things. Some real campaigning in Arizona. My name is Norma Carey. I was the African American coordinator in Arizona in the 2004 percentage campaign. And it's time to start campaigning now.
Here's what I'm going to ask you to do. In a minute, I'm going to ask Bob to come up here and talk about the campaign. And I want to just give you a few words about this. When we organize now, and we really organize by going to homes and the meetings and pulling masses of people together, this election is going to change. When people start to see a real strong showing of support in Arizona, it's going to cause heads to turn all over this country. And you can help make this happen. Because if you watch the debates, you know, I clearly established the difference between myself and the other candidates. Who obviously, you know, that's my job, okay? And what I need you to do is to start, you know, helping us organize. Now, we need a couple of things. Obviously, we need money. And Bob's going to come up here and talk about that in a moment. We need help because I depend on grassroots support. In the last campaign, we raised $13 million. It was all grassroots. This campaign, we're going to need to raise a lot more than that to be competitive. Here's what I want to tell you how we're going to win this. I want you to follow this very carefully. I think that by the time December comes along, I think that there's going to be such a hunger on the part of the American people for a real alternative, for real peace. I mean, somebody who can stand in principle for peace, who is also smart enough about politics to talk about the other things that we need in this country. I didn't get a chance to talk about health care, but I want to say this. H.R. 676, universal, single payer, not for profit out there. Issue in the election, but I need your help to organize. So, percentage.us, if you're unaware, if you're not, make sure you give us your name and phone number, we'll call you. We want to organize at the neighborhood level. Down the grassroots politician. That's how I got into politics. Knocking on those doors, okay? Can I tell you a story?
Yeah.
This is how my career began. I'm going to take you right to the very beginning of the first door I ever knocked on when I started my career 40 years ago. And then I'm going to turn this thing over to Bob. 40 years ago, I'm about to start my career by knocking on doors in Cleveland, Ohio, on Brayton Avenue, a little street, hard against the industrial flats with the smoke from the steel mills in the background. And as you know, any of us who've ever started a new endeavor, that first encounter is just is so filled with portent that whatever happens in that first moment is going to have some kind of cosmic significance. Right? I was 20 years old, okay? And I looked, you know, maybe not. So here I am, all ready to save at least Ward 7 in Cleveland. And I go to that first door. Woman starts to move towards the door. Looks like that through the screen door. And she just disappears. I'm thinking, you know, I'm standing here wondering what in the world's going on. And I didn't know enough to keep moving because this is the first door I ever knocked on in my life. And she just saw me and walked away. And I stood there for a moment just wondering if she's going to come back. And a minute later, she came back, opened the door a little bit, and her hand extended towards mine. And you know, when people's hand extends towards you, your hand extends towards them. And she looks at me with a quizzical look on her face and shrugs her shoulders and says, "I thought I already paid you for the paper."
If you just want to put in some cash, put it in the
If you want a card, you send in money later, take one of the cards. You don't have quite enough cards for everyone here. All right. Any questions about organizing or the fundraising here? Anybody, raise your hand. Can't hear you. If you come up here, you can hear me. You make out the check to the city for president 2018. I-N-E.